It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a teacher makes the case that freedom of the press should extend to high school publications.
First, it's been nearly 8 years since the United States plunged into the Great Recession. The collapse of the auto industry and the housing market sent the country's economy into a tailspin. Of course, since then, the economy has been rebounding and job growth has been moderate but steady.
However, a new report shows that while many parts of the country are bouncing back, a lot of other areas, including major urban centers like Milwaukee, are still struggling. Joining us now to talk about these disparities is Steve Glickman. He's co-founder of the Economic Innovation Group, a nonpartisan organization based in Washington that authored this report. Steve, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
So let's talk about the report. What were you trying to accomplish? What were you measuring here?
So we were measuring community well-being across the country. We looked at a number of criteria for just about every zip code across the country. It included education, housing, the rate of adults not working, the poverty rate, income, employment, and the rate of change in businesses. And we used that to heat map, essentially, the whole country and determine what communities and zip codes were the most prosperous and those that were the most distressed. And what we found was pretty surprising.
What did you find? Where were these hotspots?
Well, I think the headline for us is that the communities that were really prosperous, and those are cities like San Francisco and Los Angeles, cities like Washington, D.C., and Austin and Denver, have experienced a boom in the 5 years since the recession. They're recovering at remarkable levels. On the other hand, when you look at distressed areas, and most of these areas on a city level were in the kind of Rust Belt Midwest, the top most distressed areas were Cleveland, Detroit, Newark, and then number seven in the country was Milwaukee. Their reality is entirely different. They experienced almost no recovery during the recession. In fact, many of these cities, including Milwaukee, lost jobs and lost businesses over the course of the last 5 years. And so we're experiencing two different economic realities in this country, where there are certain cities that have been benefiting from the recovery and certain cities that have just gotten a lot worse.
Right. You could go to, and you break it down by zip code, you could go to a lot of zip codes in the rural South and in the urban Rust Belt and be correct in saying, hey, the recovery just never happened here, right?
That's exactly right. And it's a good point on the South, where we see the most distress on a state level. It's almost all southern states, led off by a state like Mississippi, where you see 40% of the people in Mississippi lived in a distressed area. You compare that to Wisconsin overall as a state, and it did actually quite well. Only 8% of the residents lived in a distressed community. But when you go to the city level in Milwaukee, you have over 50% of the population is living in a distressed community. And Milwaukee is carrying a lot of the distress for the entire state of Wisconsin.
And again, breaking it down zip code by zip code, there are places where, if you're over in this zip code, you're in good shape. If you're a few miles away in another one, you might be in really bad shape. We keep hearing about economic disparities, income disparities. We're seeing what you call a spatial disparity in a lot of places.
Yeah, that's right. Let me give you a little snapshot of what a really prosperous zip code and community and what a really distressed zip code and community feel like. In a really prosperous zip code, only like 5% of the population doesn't have a high school degree. In a distressed area, you're talking about 25% of the population doesn't have a high school degree. In a really distressed area, the poverty rate is like 30%. When in a prosperous community, it's 5%. And as we talked about a little earlier, in a distressed zip code, you see losses of jobs and businesses in a high single and low double digits. In the prosperous community, they gained 10 to 20% businesses and jobs. So it's two entirely different realities. And as you noted, when we looked at spatial inequality, we looked at to the degree that neighboring zip codes and neighboring communities were facing in these incredible economic differences. Milwaukee does all right as a city because there's so much distress throughout the city. But when you bring it out to a metropolitan area, Milwaukee is the fifth most most unequal metropolitan area in the country. So the suburbs don't bear any resemblance to what the city of Milwaukee looks like economically.
So that's interesting, because Milwaukee is known as one of the most racially segregated areas in the country. It sounds like you're saying the economic segregation, the disparity there is almost as striking.
That's right, and the two may be connected. We didn't look at demographics in this study, but what we find in a lot of communities is there's a pretty strong correlation between demographics and economic outcome in our analysis. The other, I think, really striking thing about both Wisconsin and Milwaukee is the rate of entrepreneurship. So the Kauffman Foundation has looked at this and found Wisconsin comes dead last in terms of states and entrepreneurial activity. And our data supports that, including for Milwaukee. Milwaukee does pretty poorly in connection with other cities around the country. And we saw that Milwaukee lost 3% of its businesses over the last 5 years. And that's a huge problem, because without those new businesses, it's really difficult to create new jobs and high-wage jobs. And if you look at the median income in Milwaukee compared to the rest of the state, people in Milwaukee on average are only earning about two-thirds of the income that other folks around the state of Wisconsin are earning.
Talking to Steve Glickman from the Economic Innovation Group about a new report with graphics demonstrating income disparity, economic opportunity, I should say, disparities around the country, at local levels, at state levels. So, Steve, we've got this information now, these very striking graphics that you can look at the national level, at a state level. You can drill down to zip code to zip code. What are you hoping that people, policymakers, maybe do with this information, with these charts?
Well, I think our biggest focus and one of the areas that bind a lot of the most distressed areas relates to investment and access to capital. We're at a sort of stage in the economic recovery of the U.S. where we need some kind of radical change in how we think about the way we drive investment and businesses to cities and communities that haven't recovered along with the rest of the country. There has long been a history, and this is kind of the silver lining, of bipartisan cooperation around these type of geographic incentives that provide certain types of benefits for investors to move investments and businesses into communities that have fallen behind in order to stimulate job growth and business growth locally. And if you don't do something like that, it's really hard to recover, because we're seeing the communities like Milwaukee in this downward spiral where they start to lose businesses, and those obviously take jobs with them. That takes away the tax base for the local city to be able to fund big infrastructure projects, which make that city less competitive for new investment. So unless you step in and do something different where you create a new attraction for the private sector to come in and invest, there's a real threat that Milwaukee will continue to do worse and worse every year.
But I wonder, if we're looking at these economically distressed areas, if we're talking about a Rust Belt city like Milwaukee or those rural areas in the deep south, lack of financial economic resources can sometimes translate into a lack of political influence, of political capital to advocate for those kind of things you're talking about. So what would it take to get that kind of targeted support for these areas?
Well, the good news is there are already a group of members of Congress working on it. It's a bipartisan group led by Wisconsin a native and Ron Kind. He, along with Pat Tiberi from Ohio and Senators Tim Scott from South Carolina and Cory Booker in New Jersey, have formed a working group in Congress to look at this very issue, to find new ways and formulas to create the type of incentives that will get investors to pay attention to communities like Milwaukee and elsewhere in the Midwest, and as you noted, the rural parts of the South. There's some hope. And on top of that, you see both Speaker Paul Ryan making poverty a huge priority for his new leadership in Congress, and reaching out to the Congressional Black Caucus to try to find some new solutions, as well as President Obama offering his take on promise zones and the need to focus geographically on the parts of the country that have recovered the least. So there is some nascent energy in that space. We'd like to see more members and certainly the presidential candidates focus on this issue as well.
So that's your hope for help for these economically troubled, distressed areas around the country. What's your fear, I guess? What are the consequences of inaction as you see it?
Well, I mean, there's several, and I'll tell you what the most scary one is for us. There's been some more and more recent research that have tied where you grow up to where you'll end up in life. So that being poor in certain communities, like let's take Seattle or San Francisco, is a lot different than being poor in a Milwaukee or Detroit. Your chances of getting out of poverty, of moving from the bottom 20% socioeconomically to the top 20% in a Seattle or San Francisco, is something close to 10 to 15%. In these rural city, in these Rust Belt cities in the Midwest, the numbers are a lot closer to zero. And so what's happening is the American dream is being limited to those who happen to grow up in the right part of the country. They happen to be born in the right zip code, and that's just not what, you know, the American values are all about. And we're really not just sacrificing the future for children across the country, but even more so, it's leading to a huge amount of political uncertainty and chaos in this country, where you see you see populism being much more attractive for candidates being found outside the mainstream, and that's creating some real, I think, political challenges for the country right now.
Steve, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Steve Glickman. He's co-founder of the Economic Innovation Group, which just released a report on economically distressed areas of the United States.
Coming up, we talked to a high school teacher about the importance of press freedoms for school newspapers.
A couple years ago, the student magazine at Fond du Lac High School published an article about sexual assault. In response, the school administration came up with a policy that would allow them to effectively censor future stories.
As a result, the magazine's faculty advisor recently joined a movement in Wisconsin to promote press freedom for student journalists. And Matthew Smith joins us now. He's a teacher at Fond du Lac High School and a member of the New Voices movement in Wisconsin. Matthew, thanks a lot for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Matthew, can you take us back to that original story that brought about this issue of press freedom for students? What was it about? What happened?
It was titled The Rape Joke. And I think the impetus was that the student reporters felt that rape was being used as a joke, as sort of a laugh line in the school. And we wanted to shed light on the fact that we have students at the school, it's a large school, who have experienced sexual assault, for whom hearing jokes like that was horrific, and just wanted to make it clear that this is, sexual assault is a real problem throughout the country, and that the culture everywhere, not just at our school, but sort of everywhere in the country, maybe took that a little too flippantly. It didn't take it seriously enough, the harm that you could cause by joking around about things that were that serious.
So the piece was critical of the school, and not just the school, but the cultural response. Is that right?
Yeah, and it wasn't really critical of the school so much as it included some students being very frank about their experiences, and that they were anonymous sources, they were protected, but you know, it did include some frank language, and it was very upfront about what these experiences were like and how these students feel when they see it taken lightly.
And what was the response from the school administration?
I mean, overall, it had a great response in the school. I know it was read by just about every student, I think, and I think it was being used in some classes for class discussions. It was a month afterward or so that we received new guidelines from the school district saying, I was told that there was an understanding as to why we did that story, that they wanted new policy would mean that the principal needed to review from now on and approve all future stories. So it came about a month afterward.
Were there specific objections?
That always kind of went back and forth for that story. I think objections included some of the artwork, which was a female student just holding up a sheet of paper that where they had kind of written on the title and some stats they had gotten. There was objection to some of the language, to a few things. I never had a clear picture of exactly what about that story was specifically objectionable, just that it was made very clear to me right away that from now on they wanted to review and approve.
As an advisor, did you have any hesitations, any red flags go up for you when you were contemplating publishing this piece?
I mean, it was a very sensitive topic. And I think, I mean, what's so great about the way we operate now, the way we operated then, and the way that we're pushing for new voices is students need to learn that they are responsible for what they say and need to be given a chance to take that seriously. So when we were doing that story, I know the reporter and some of the editors, there were lots of conversations. I remember there were times when certain sections, certain quotes in the story were highlighted to be seen with question marks written by the students themselves saying, should we say this? Is this okay? What do you think? With different wordings. Went back and forth a lot. I took it very seriously. The students did too. And I think we forget sometimes that not everyone's aware that that's going on. Like how seriously that was taken, how purposefully that story was put together to have the best positive impact for the community.
And Matthew, you're now a member of the New Voices movement in Wisconsin. How did that experience in that Fond du Lac High School catapult you to get involved in the conversation about press freedoms for students?
I think more than anything, I think I was naive before in thinking that everyone understood best practices for journalism education and for journalism, and understood the training that we receive and the way that our professional code of ethics implore us to proceed for best learning. So I think I mostly was shocked. I kind of shaken awake that the fact that a lot of the principals and other school district personnel and other people don't know that what we're doing is best. They don't know all the rigorous work that's going into it. After that, and after seeing my students do everything they could to get that policy reversed, which they did, it woke me up that that could happen again, not just at Fond du Lac maybe, but at any school. There's lots of schools where I think the schools would feel totally empowered to take control of student media and not know the damage that they could be doing to education.
Are there any legal protections for student journalism, especially high school journalists, right now on the books?
There's quite a lot, actually. Primarily the First Amendment, which is that's in the Constitution, and we have lots of court cases upholding that, making it clear that students still have constitutional rights in school. But the problem is what we have to go by, without a state law, without state legislators taking the lead to help clarify things that's for best for student learning. Without that, we have a bunch of court cases that all overlap in different ways, and I think make it hard not just for an advisor and students in the class to know exactly what we're supposed to be doing or allowed to be doing, but certainly for administrators and principals and school district officials, they don't have a background in that. There's no way they're going to study up all about Hazelwood and Tinker and Dean versus Utica and all these other court cases that make it clear that schools are not allowed to censor student speech just because they don't like the message or they disagree with that point of view. That is always protected. With or without a state law, you can't just, a government official in the form of a public school cannot just shut down speech for point of view.
And there was a recent case in North Dakota that got at this. What can you tell us about that particular case?
Yeah, I think, for me, a couple of years ago when stuff happened with our paper, it woke me up to the need for something. But I wasn't sure how to go about it or whether it would be even possible to get a law passed here as they have in several other states already. But last year, North Dakota was able to get such a bill passed unanimously. It had such strong support all across the political spectrum. And I think me watching that and talking to some of the people who were instrumental in that in North Dakota really inspired me, seeing that it can happen. And when you educate people enough and when you get the conversation going, it becomes very clear how much this is a win-win for everyone. Teaching students to know their rights and use their rights and act responsibly and learn to use their voice responsibly, that's really important now since they all have their cell phones on them. They're publishing stuff all day. We need to make sure that they're taking ethics into consideration, that they're trying to do what's best. And they need real practice doing that.
And this was a unanimous thing in North Dakota, and I know New Voices has tried to encourage similar things to happen here in Wisconsin, but it has not been a bipartisan response here that you've seen. It sounds like there's some Democratic support, but what do you want legislators to know about why you think this could be a bipartisan issue?
Because I think students learning their rights and really practicing them and when students try to do the right thing and they're trying to get good messages out, to know that they're going to be able to do that, I think is really powerful. I think here in Fond du Lac, what happened a year and a half or 2 years ago, I think is an amazing example of what you get from a journalism program where students know that they own their own voices. And we operated for years that way without any censorship or review. And I think that you can see in the response to the censorship that students had learned, you know, this is how I respond to something I think that's unjust. I respond in a civil way. I start conversations. I speak up for myself at school board meetings. I write letters to things. I build support, and I get things changed the right way. And I think the fact that our students were able to do that, I think, is the best illustration possible of how great that education was before, how great it was that they were used to owning their own voices and making responsible decisions.
And just very briefly as we wrap up, but what would you say to school district officials who might say that's all great, but I'm the one who's going to have to answer to parents who might be upset with what's being published?
Oh, I totally understand that. I guess I'd mostly say this bill is nothing to, you know, all these new voices laws across in other states do nothing to restrict a school's ability to try to prohibit or punish speech that is truly illegal or harmful. Like, students are not allowed, are not given a free pass, no matter what, to do really harmful things to people, to bully people, to libel or invade privacy or disrupt the school environment. They're not allowed to do that anyway. And this bill is nothing to keep schools from keeping students safe in the building. I think too often, without a law like this to make it sure that schools aren't reviewing and censoring, schools start censoring for the wrong reasons, you know, without even thinking about it.
And Matthew, we leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Matthew Smith, teacher at Fond du Lac High School and a member of the New Voices movement in Wisconsin.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farron.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we talk about the recently appointed Department of Corrections Secretary's first public appearance. The appointment comes amid ongoing investigations into abuse and misconduct allegations at a youth detention facility.
First, President Obama visited Milwaukee today to celebrate an increase in enrollment for the Affordable Care Act. Wisconsin's the only state using the Affordable Care Act to expand its Medicaid program while declining federal funds to pay for it. WPR reporter Chuck Quirnbach followed the story. He joins us now from our studios in downtown Milwaukee. Chuck, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Well, can you tell us what brought the president exactly to Milwaukee to talk today?
Well, last fall, the White House launched a Healthy Communities Challenge, trying to get 20 metro areas with high numbers of uninsured to compete to get people to sign up. Milwaukee did not win in the raw numbers of enrollees, but certainly won the percentage based on population size. 38,000 people in the Milwaukee area signed up under the Health Insurance Marketplace Program, and along with about 51,000 others, returnees, the city area or the area came up with about 89,000 people. That's why President Obama was saying that's more than people can fit into Lambeau Field.
And what did the president say about why this was so successful, or what do we know about why this program worked there?
Well, it's certainly been controversial. It's worked according to some folks, and I don't think there's been a lot of media reports about people who have signed up who've been upset. Certainly there's been reports about people who have gotten coverage being happy. The president had lunch with several of them today in Milwaukee near where he spoke. And one of the gentlemen who had written the president a letter, Brent Brown of Mosinee, explained that he didn't care for the president, didn't vote for him a couple times, but after Mr. Brown was diagnosed with a serious disease, he did say that being part of the Affordable Care Act saved his life. So Mr. Brown gave his preliminary speech and warm-up speech to the president.
And you shared some audio from the event with us. Can you set that up for us, Chuck?
Well, sure. Plan, as I say, controversial. Hearing today from Attorney General Brad Schimmel, Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson, yesterday from Governor Scott Walker, who said, sure, greater enrollment is good, but we don't trust still the federal promise to pay for it. And so Wisconsin has kind of gone on its own using the authority, but not the federal money. The president today commented about the governor.
And by the way, Milwaukee, while you worked your tails off to cover enough folks to fill Lambeau Field, your governor still refuses to expand Medicaid in this state. And we could cover another 21,000 Wisconsinites with a stroke of his pen.
Was that just a one-off, or was the president generally critical of Wisconsin's policy here?
Well, he also spoke against briefly referring to Senator Johnson and also, but not really by name, I think, Paul Ryan, the House Speaker, of course, from Wisconsin. Obviously, 2016 election year, Senator Johnson being a critic of the Affordable Care Act, a Democratic, likely Democratic candidate, Russ Feingold in favor of the Affordable Care Act. And, of course, the presidential candidates are coming to town soon. Mr. Obama did not get into the presidential race today, but everybody knows generally speaking, the Republican candidates oppose Affordable Care Act. Democrats generally favor it. So more to come on that in a key battleground state.
And I understand the president visited a community center in Milwaukee. That's been part of a kind of a sign-up effort. Is that right?
Right. He was at the United Community Center, a very large Latino-focused organization. He spoke in the gym of Bruce Guadalupe School there. Looked to be a very diverse group of audience members, Latino arts group performed beforehand and so on. So energizing a base or reaching out to key Latino voters, trying to get everybody enthused, probably at target of the Democrats in this appearance.
Chuck, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That's WPR reporter Chuck Kornbach joining us from Milwaukee on the president's visit to that city to celebrate Obamacare signups there. Healthcare has been a part of the presidential campaign, with Donald Trump releasing his own policy statement on the topic this week, likely topic in tonight's Republican debate. UW-Stevens Point political science professor Ed Miller joins us now for more on the topic. Ed, welcome back to the show.
Good evening.
Well, we heard Chuck provide us with that audio there of President Obama criticizing Governor Walker for the state's decision not to take those federal funds to support Medicaid expansion. We're unique in the country in that. Is that right?
Well, no. Actually, there are about 19 states that haven't taken, haven't expanded Medicaid. And those states are not, they're Republican. All those states are Republican states, but all Republican governors have not followed that path. Christie, for example, did not. Indiana has not. Ohio has not. And because they realize how much money is involved, that their citizens would be covered for one, and second, how much money. Wisconsin, as they say, is leaving a tremendous amount of money on the table. Over a 10-year period, it's close to $1 billion Wisconsin is giving up for not taking the expansion.
The unique part, as I understand it, is that we've expanded health care to cover a lot of people not previously covered, changed it to remove it from others while not taking that Medicaid expansion.
Well, we actually reduced the number covered because in Wisconsin, we covered up to 200% of the federal poverty line. And now we're covering only 100% of the federal poverty line under Medicaid. The addition, as you mentioned, there is an addition there. And that is individuals without children. And they were covered under Doyle up to the 200%, but there was a limited amount of money, so there was a waiting list there, and people couldn't get it because of the waiting list, or some people couldn't get it. So what Governor Walker did was those individuals who were under 100% of the poverty line that didn't have children are now eligible. So that is one addition, that's true. But there was a lot of people who had previously received it who no longer get it.
So Governor Walker has he argued when he initially made this decision, and his office is still saying that today, that, okay, all this money appears to be there from the federal government now. It's uncertain, massive debt. This could change, and we may get ourselves in a position where we have this, in effect, unfunded mandate where we'd have to be scrambling
right
in a few years to pay for it all.
Right.
What do you make of that?
Well, that argument never made any sense to me. For one thing is the federal government is paying. And so all the states that have it, the federal government is paying. If what Governor Walker says comes to be true, that the federal government then runs out of money in some way, although there are tax sources for this. But if the federal government doesn't pay, that's all the state of Wisconsin has to say is, well, I'm sorry, we did cover these people. Well, now there's no federal money. We can't afford it. So they could stop it right at that time. The state wouldn't be holding the bag for anything. The state could make that decision if that happened to the federal government. But the probability is that it will not.
So we've heard recently from Senator Ron Johnson, from Republican presidential candidates, that the Affordable Care Act ultimately has driven premiums up. So have premiums grown faster than they did before this law came into effect?
No. Premiums have been going up, and not necessarily faster than before. I mean, you can just look at the data in terms of the premiums going up, increased copayments, increased deductibles. All of that has gone up, and that has continued to some extent. But it depends on what market you're in. In some markets, it hasn't gone up, and those are the markets that are most competitive for insurance company. Other markets, it has gone up, but the decisions on that has nothing to do with the Affordable Care Act per se. Those decisions are made by the insurance companies. So insurance companies actually make the decision on what their pricing is. Under the Affordable Care Act, if premiums go up, it is up to the state, because the state regulates insurance, to review any premium that goes up more than 10%. And so states are given that responsibility.
Now, turning to presidential politics, Republican candidates, I should say, have offered various plans for health care. But the starting point generally is repeal the Affordable Care Act, repeal Obamacare. I just wanted to ask how politically feasible that is, unless the Republicans, and I don't think people expect them to do this, end up with a filibuster-proof majority in the Senate.
Right. It's probably not politically feasible. It's a law that's already in effect. It has a tremendous effect. But what a lot of people don't realize is how wide-ranging, how broad that this law has an effect. So if you repeal the law, just simply repeal the law, you've got children up to 26 that can now be on their parents' policies. You have pre-existing conditions which can be excluded by insurers, which, by the way, is one of the reasons that individual policies have gone up. It has no effect upon policies you get from your employer, because they already cover pre-existing conditions. But for individual policies now, at one time they would not write policies for people who had pre-existing conditions or excluded them. Now they can't. But in addition to that, there's additional services in Medicare. There's a lot of people out there who have Medicare, and they think, well, I have Medicare. This has absolutely nothing to do with the Affordable Care Act. Well, the Affordable Care Act added a whole bunch of services to Medicare. Those services would all go away. In addition to that, if you have a private policy and you do have deductibles and copayments, as most people do, under the Affordable Care Act, preventative services such as the visit to the doctor, colonoscopies, vaccinations, all of that cannot apply the deductible or the copayment. And so those preventative services no longer would be without pay for the patient. In addition to that, there's a whole bunch of other stuff in there, such as reducing hospital infection rates, which have really come down because of the act and so forth. So there is really a lot more in this act than it looks like. You know, people think about the individual mandate. Well, whether you like it or not, you can debate that. But the point is, to repeal the entire Affordable Care Act, there's a lot of parts to it. So the question then is, if you're going to repeal it, what parts are you going to save?
We're talking about health care and presidential politics after President Obama's visit today to Milwaukee. Ed Miller stays with us. He's a political scientist from UW-Stevens Point.
And you can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. Should the next president replace Obamacare with something else, or is the Affordable Care Act working? Let us know what you think by calling in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our discussion on healthcare and presidential politics in the wake of President Obama's visit to Milwaukee today. Ed Miller is our guest. He's a political scientist from UW-Stevens Point.
You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on the Affordable Care Act, on Obamacare. Has it affected your life and maybe your workplace for better or for worse? Does it need changing, stay as it is, complete repeal? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers now. We've got Jim on the line in Iowa. Jim, hi.
Hi. I'm wondering about your guest thoughts about Bernie Sanders' plan of making a single-payer plan. We have insurance companies which basically wrote the legislation and take 15 or 20% out of every health care dollar without contributing one aspirin.
Jim, thanks for the call. So, yeah, this has been a debate on the Democratic side of the presidential field, too, Ed, saying we need to go further, Bernie Sanders is.
Right, and the Sanders, the single-payer plan would be cheaper. It also, because, as Jim said, it doesn't include a lot of administrative expenses, which are much lower, like, for example, in Medicare. So it would be better in that way. It would also be more uniform. It would not necessarily have networks as the current plan has, because everybody would be the same, like with Medicare. And so in that case, it would be better in that respect. And this is similar to Canada. A lot of people say Canada has socialized medicine. Well, they don't. What they do have is socialized insurance. So it is actually on the province level, the various plans in Canada. However, the chance that that's going to be enacted is pretty remote. With the current Affordable Care Act, there was an attempt to get in a public option, just an option, that compete with private insurance, and that was a non-starter, and that was then removed. And some facsimile of an option, the co-op, was put in, and they're not doing very well right at the moment.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go next to Whitney in Kaukauna. Whitney, hi.
Hi. I work for a big insurance company in Green Bay, and I work directly actually with the marketplace on individual policies, and there's a huge disconnect between insurance companies or actually the members and the providers that are in the network, because the providers think that Obamacare is an entity, as do the members. And the minute that any provider hears the word Obamacare, they automatically say, nope, we don't accept that plan, even when we have a contractual agreement with that provider, and we can, you know, state the facts in there, but they won't take the plan because they don't think that anything is going to be coming to them for payment, because they think it's a handout and things like that. And it's very, very frustrating having to try and get members access to providers when they're constantly turning members away because they hear the word Obamacare and automatically are, you know, stigmatized to that, oh, this is just a government handout, when it's not. It's actually, there's a lot of things that need to be worked out with it, because there's a lot of kinks still, where if you have to meet a certain amount that you make each year and file for taxes in order to qualify for a tax credit, and then if you don't qualify for a tax credit and your state didn't expand Medicaid like ours did it, you don't qualify for Medicaid. So
all right. Whitney, you brought a lot to the table. Thank you so much for sharing your experience working with that. And Ed, this was a criticism of the Affordable Care Act from some people back when it was passing. Whether people were agreed with or opposed to the provisions, there was maybe a thought that this is big, this is a lot, this is complex, it's too much to hit doctors and insurance companies and patients with all at once.
Right, it is complex. And that's one of the problems with it, that it is complex. But what Whitney says is absolutely true. There is no such policy such as Obamacare. You can't buy Obamacare. What it is a marketplace in which private insurers compete in the individual market for policy, people to buy their policies. And so that's what you find. And so people have a choice among private insurance companies to buy the policy. The only thing not private is, of course, Medicaid. I mean, that, you know, is run as a federal state program, but that's always been. But I'm talking about individuals who buy the policies. It is essentially all private insurance companies, and the federal government will subsidize the premiums depending upon your income. And so it's income up to 400% of the federal poverty line, and it goes down as you get closer to that, the subsidies. But in terms of the policies themselves and the nature of the policies themselves, those are all private insurance companies.
Thanks a lot for that call, Whitney. We're talking to Ed Miller from UW-Stevens Point about the politics of health care. President Obama visiting Milwaukee today. Republican presidential candidates likely to talk about this some tonight at their debate. We'll go back to our callers with John in Manitowoc. John, hi.
Hi, I work at a debt collection office, and business is booming for medical debt. Obamacare has not helped with that. People are getting denied with their claims. They go to hospitals. They have insurance. The hospital doesn't take that insurance policy, or the hospital's not processing it, or they have a deductible that's so high that they end up not being able to pay it. And really, it seems like, you know, what we get for insurance is just insurance for the hospitals that people aren't going to be able to declare, you know, bankruptcy for huge sums against them.
John, thanks a lot for the call. So he's seeing, you know, this isn't doing part of what it's supposed to do to make that medical expense a non-catastrophic event. Adam.
Right. And what he says is true. I mean, that in effect, deductibles are going up. People would have to pay more in terms of deductibles. But the other thing he says is a very concerning thing, and that is this network thing. And the network thing that you have, that these networks, insurance companies, what they're doing is they're narrowing the networks so that they can make better deals with physician groups. And what happens is that not only is there fewer doctors that you can go to, but the patient may misunderstand what the network is. And sometimes the network is really confusing because you see there's a hospital. You know, and that hospital is on your list. And so you have some kind of problems. You break your arm, you break your leg, and you go into that hospital. You're treated in the emergency room. Where else are you going to be treated? In that particular hospital. That emergency room, those doctors, may not be in network. Hmm. And which is really strange, that the hospital is in network, but the doctors at the emergency room, which you think, because the hospital is listed there, are not in network. And so that's a real problem that needs to be straightened out.
We'll bring on another caller now. Vic is with us in Stevens Point. Vic, hi.
Yeah, hi, and thanks to your guest, Ed. So, you know, that example that you just used is something that I look at and say, well, that's okay that we have these problems. Initially, it's going to have an effect on those people that it's affecting, of course, but those are things that can be tweaked. A real example for me why I think it should not be repealed, I think that's just ridiculous, is my direct experience that I have with my own children. I have four boys, all the way up to age 25. For them to be able, I teach in the Stevens Point area, but I look at just my students, but I look at my own kids, that I can keep them on until age 26. That's pretty incredible. Why would I want to deny that to my own children? So,
Vic, thanks a lot for that call. I want to take his first point, though, Ed, the idea that there are tweaks needed. Even people who like the Affordable Care Act probably don't think it's perfect, but in this political climate, can tweaks be made?
Right, and that's the biggest problem. So, well, some tweaks can be made because they can be made administratively through regulations. But anything that needs legislation is an impossibility. There was a technical error in the law, and the technical error lives in the law of whether the subsidies go only to state exchanges or they go to the federal exchange. It was only a technical error because if you read the law, anyway, it had to go to the court, the Supreme Court, to make the decision. While that could easily have been done in a four-word addition to the law by Congress, and it just simply couldn't be done.
So, Ed, as we wrap up, do you see this remaining as a hot issue in the presidential campaign?
Oh, I think that they will talk about repeal, and it will be an issue. Certainly, Republicans will. The House of Representatives have voted, what was it last year, 50-some times to repeal the Affordable Care Act, and so it will be an issue. The interesting thing, what will happen is if there remains a Republican Senate. Well, the Republican Senate would have to be a filibuster-proof Senate and a Republican president, then they could conceivably repeal it. But even if there's a Republican president, and there will probably be a Republican House, as long as the Senate is below 60% Republicans, the chance of repealing it is pretty remote because of the fact is that the filibuster would prevent that.
Ed, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're very welcome.
That's UW Stevens Point political science professor Ed Miller talking about some of the 2016 presidential candidates' ideas on reforming health care and the politics of health care in this presidential election year.
Coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR, and then we talk about the new Department of Corrections secretary's hopes to restore public trust after scandal at a youth detention facility. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.